Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this episode, which is all about the 1945 noir classic Detour. Edgar G. Ulmer's film, of course, starring Tom Neill and Anne Savage. And I'm delighted to be joined on the podcast once again by Andy Wolverton. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. And how about yourself? It's been a little while. So, yeah, how are things going? And I always ask you about the library. So, you know, how are things going with your screenings? And you've been showing some good stuff recently, haven't you?
Yeah, we've had a lot of fun lately. We've got we recently did Night of the Living Dead for Ooh. October, which was a very interesting experience. A lot of people thought that it might not be for them, so a few stayed away, but yeah. Most of them took a chance and they really enjoyed it.
And how are you approaching Noirvember then? Because I saw something you posted yesterday about this actually, and yeah, you got an interesting lineup for this month, haven't you? So what was the kind of thought process there, and what kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased to we're having our own little Noirvember film festival for the month of Noirvember, and I got to thinking about it, and I do show a noir from time to time, but a lot of times when I show those, I'll get questions from people like, why is noir a thing? Why is it important? Why are we talking about it today? And I thought, you know, I need to do just a little noir 101 festival. So yeah. So if these are the only three films that you watch, you'll have a pretty good understanding of where noir is coming from and why it still matters. So for that festival, I'm going to do it's going to be three Thursdays in November. Mm-hmm. Of course, we won't do Thanksgiving, which is our fourth Thursday here. Mm-hmm. And we'll start out with Double Indemnity. And yep. The next week we will do The Killers, the 1946 mm-hmm. version. And then we will end with Out of the Past, 1947.
So that's interesting. So you think those three, it's like film noir distilled. Well, I guess I can see where you're coming from there, especially with Double Indemnity to kick it off. So yeah, that's great, I think. We should talk a bit more about your interest in film noir then, because I think the other films we've discussed haven't been noir, have they? I mean, some people would argue that you maybe see a hint of noir in Casablanca, but it wouldn't necessarily typically be categorized as such. So yeah, tell me a bit about that, Andy, because I know you're very passionate about film noir. So like, what's the genesis of that? How did that come to be?
You know, I think it may have happened when my mother used to watch this classic show on every Sunday afternoon. It was a classic movie show on our local channel, and I always dismissed it. I was interested in things, cool things like Star Wars, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and I said one Sunday to her, "Why are you watching this junk? It's all in black and white. Nobody cares about this stuff." And she says, "Listen, just sit down and watch this one movie that's coming on. It's called The Maltese Falcon. Oh. And watch this. And if you don't like it, you can get up and leave." And Carl, I was absolutely hooked. I could not get enough. I really don't know what it was. I know probably Bogart had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
And the other characters, the characters in that film are so rich. They're so great. And I decided I've got to learn more about this stuff. And it really didn't kick back in until probably about 5 years ago when I went to a Noir City Festival here in Washington, D.C., and met Eddie Muller. And I think I wrote down every word he said. It was just like going to Film Noir University.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you a bit more about the film noir circuit, you know, the Noir City events and so on. So what are those like exactly? So what are we talking, like a weekend kind of festival type thing, is it, with screenings and panels and the like? Is that the kind of thing it is?
Well, actually, there's no panels, at least the ones I've been to. I've been to the D.C. one, the San Francisco flagship, which kicks off the year in January. And this year I went to the Chicago Festival for the first time. And all of those festivals differ slightly. Some are longer than others. I think the film festival in Detroit is only for a weekend, and the San Francisco one is for 2 weeks. The DC one is for 10 days. But it's basically just fans getting together to watch these films. Many of them are shown in 35mm. Thankfully, we still have a few theaters that can project in 35mm.
Yep.
So when those can be done, those are done that way. And then we have people like the Film Noir Foundation, who is responsible for the restoration and preservation for these great films. Some of them, you know, haven't seen the light of day since they were first shown in theaters, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago. And just getting to talk to people, experts like Eddie Muller, Alan K. Rohde, Foster Hirsch, and just other fans, it's just a wonderful thing. There's this thriving community that really loves these films, and it's always great to see new people come in. And it's funny because every time I go to San Francisco, almost invariably I will sit next to a person and I will ask them, you know, how long have you been coming to the festival? And they usually say, I just walked in off the street to see what this looks like. It sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. A film like I Wake Up Screaming, I have to see what that's all about.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I was going to ask you, I'm glad you used the word thriving, because I was wondering, well, maybe I wonder if the fan community kind of skews older. But no, it sounds from what you're saying that film noir continues to attract new fans, is it? So that's pleasing to hear.
It is encouraging. And one of the things Eddie Muller says a lot is that film noir is the gateway drug to classic cinema. And I think it's the cynicism that younger audiences pick up on, and maybe even the sense of despair, fate. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure exactly what it is, but they keep coming. I'm always trying to get younger people to come to my shows at the library. I wish I could get more. I'm still working on it, mm-hmm. trying to get the college crowd, trying to get the teenage crowd. It's a hard sell for some of them, but we keep working.
Well, arguably, there's lots of reasons to feel fatalistic and doomed today.
Yes.
So, let's move things on a bit to Detour then. So this was a film I've only seen comparatively recently. This was a film I'd always see references to in books and articles about film noir, and it always sounded highly fascinating. But I didn't have the opportunity to see it really, or I didn't seek it out until the Criterion Collection release, which we might talk a little bit more about as well. But how about you, Andy? What's your kind of history with this film? I'm guessing yours predates mine.
I have seen Detour a few times, and I think the first time I saw it was years and years ago. I got a really cheap box set of film noir titles, and Detour was one of them. And these were all public domain titles, mm-hmm. so anybody could release a DVD of them. And you could tell, too, the quality was not very good. And, you know, you put the disc in and Detour starts, and it's really, I mean, it looks low budget anyway. And I was just taken by the story. The story is just so captivating. And I know we'll get into the particulars, but if all you have seen of Detour is the Criterion restoration, you really should find out what it really looked like before this to make you appreciate how good the Criterion is.
Yes, there's something fascinating about that, isn't there? Because, I mean, I've seen it now a few times, and I think it's excellent, and I think it deserves the attention that it's had from Criterion. But like you kind of say, it's a film that's very down and dirty. It was very cheaply made, and we'll talk about that, but it shows as well at times, shot extremely quickly. And a film that didn't seem to acquire this reputation until later on. So there's something kind of interesting there, isn't there, about how painstaking the efforts were to restore it and all of that, given the fact that the film itself was apparently made, you know, at breakneck speed.
Absolutely. And I was talking to, I was listening to a podcast where they were talking about new releases, and they mentioned the Detour release when it first came out. And they said, really what you should do is watch the restoration short that's on the Blu-ray and DVD mm-hmm. first. Yep. To give you a better appreciation of what they went to, which was extraordinary lengths to restore the film. And I won't go into the details because I would rather people watch that. But it's incredible mm-hmm. the amount of work that actually went into this to make this a Criterion-level disc.
Yes. Now, in terms of the podcast here, I think it makes an interesting contrast with the last film we covered, which was a couple of weeks ago. We talked about The Postman Always Rings Twice. Mm-hmm. And on that episode, we were talking about how that film, you know, it's made by MGM. A lot of people seem to think of it as quite a sanitized film, you know, too glossy considering the source material and that kind of thing. So Detour's an interesting counterpoint, isn't it? Because it's many things, this film, but glossy is not one of them.
For sure.
In a number of ways, which we'll talk about. But I guess we could talk about these people, first of all. Because I think one obvious point of difference with The Postman Always Rings Twice is that here in Detour, you have performers who, they're not household names, are they? They wouldn't generally be known to moviegoers. So we've got, you know, hardcore film buffs might know people like Tom Neal and Anne Savage from other things. But generally speaking, most people won't know much about them, I don't think. But arguably, that serves the film well, doesn't it? Because, you know, Neil's character, Al, he's like an ambiguous figure in a lot of ways. And Vera's this very bitter figure who's kind of very interesting and kind of lacking in humanity in some respects. So, yeah, what do you think about these performers here? And let's start with Tom Neal as Al. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, I think we should talk about the performers and the characters that they're playing as well. It's kind of hard to separate them. Like you said, most people will not come to the film knowing much about Tom Neal or Anne Savage, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about both of them later. But, you know, one of the things I couldn't help thinking of when I was watching this film this time is in the opening shot, as Al Roberts mm-hmm. is walking down the street at night, a car zooms by, and I couldn't help thinking they'd be doing him a favor if they just flattened him right there. Because Al is such a loser. He's such a sad sack. And you really can't think of anybody else besides Tom Neal who could have played Al with the same look of resignation, you know, the weak face. Yeah. You know, he practically is saying, go ahead and hit me. Everybody else does. And he actually does say, my favorite sport is being kept prisoner. So he really does. He looks more at home on the road than he does in some of the earlier scenes where he's dressed up and he's playing the piano. So I think it's the weary sad sack that we really remember, though.
Yeah, he can come across as kind of a pathetic figure, can't he, in some respects? And some of the, like, the narration at times is quite self-pitying, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And some people have read that as very significant. You know, but the voiceover, at times he's speaking directly to the audience. And some commentators think there's a difference between what the visuals are telling us and what the voiceover is suggesting. The suggestion is, I think, that if the voiceover is self-serving, the deaths in the film possibly appear to be too convenient. Perhaps Al is more implicated when it first appears. Maybe he's an unreliable narrator. And I hadn't thought about this the first time I saw the film. It completely passed me by. I took everything at face value. But then later, just reading around, I discovered there was this line of thinking about it. So, have you come across that? And like, what do you think? Do we take him to be an unreliable narrator, or are there people who think that perhaps reading too much into the film?
I think you could really make a case for that. In fact, I ran across a critic named Andrew Britton in Ian Cameron's book of film noir that argues that Al really isn't giving us the story of what happened, but is instead giving us the story of what he believed happened, or his fantasy version of what really happened, that we really shouldn't accept Al's story on face value. In fact, you know, some of the nightclub scenes would lead us to believe that this was at least partly fantasy, suggesting that maybe Sue was almost predestined to make it big while Al sits at the piano and hardly anybody notices. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like this is a little precursor to David Lynch's Mulholland Drive with a little bit of internal fantasy element going on in Al's mind. So I think you could make a strong case for that.
And that kind of enigmatic thing goes all the way through to the final scene, doesn't it? Because at the end, when he's walking along the road and he's picked up by the police. So in some respects, you can say, oh, there's your Hays Code compliant kind of ending. Mm-hmm. But then the voiceover seems to be talking about this as something that's going to happen like someday. You know, I didn't quite know how to take that.
I kind of didn't know how to take it either. And I read some critics, and I read one in particular that said the film is a masterpiece until that last minute. That it's kind of a cheat. And I'm not sure if I agree with that completely. I think it's consistent with the rest of the film. But yeah, I mean, that's something that's certainly interesting to think about.
Yeah, I think so. Because so at various points in the film, he addresses the audience directly. So start your sermon, I'll listen to it, and stuff like that. So I think from reading some of these critics, I'm kind of persuaded that his narration, you can read it as an after-the-fact rationalization or something. Like I said, it didn't occur to me, so it's not like I've had this original insight or anything, but I think that reading of the film does work, doesn't it? And I think, does that make it a much more interesting film if that's going on than it would otherwise be? I think it does add an extra kind of wrinkle that's kind of fascinating to think about, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it gives you a little something extra to think about rather than having everything wrapped up real tidy at the end, like some of the production code mandated in some of the films during the classic noir period.
And what do you know about Tom Neal besides this? Because I've just come across this fascinating story about what happened to him later in life. I'm sure you come across it too in your reading. But yeah, do you know much about him beyond this film?
Well, yeah, he was – this is such a weird story.
Yeah.
And you probably ran across it too. It was almost like he really was Al Roberts in real life. If you don't know much about Neal, it's definitely worth exploring. He had a really interesting beginning. He had an Ivy League education. He was a boxer in college. And he worked in B-films pretty steadily in the 40s. And famously had an affair with the actress Barbara Payton. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in her autobiography, Payton said of Neal, this is a quote, "He had a chemical buzz for me that sent red peppers down my thighs." I thought, wow. And yeah. So when Payton married Barbara Payton married French O'Tone, Neal roughed Tone up so much he came close to killing him. And after a while, Neal quit the movie business and started a landscaping company. And I think this was his second wife, Patricia Fenton, died. Once she died, Neal sent his one-year-old son to live with Neal's sister. Mm-hmm. And after that, Neal married a woman named Gail Clocky. And then 4 years later, that wife was shot to death and Neal was arrested for the murder. Mm-hmm. He was convicted for involuntary manslaughter and spent 6 years in prison, but it gets even weirder. Several months after he was released from prison, Neal died of a heart attack in a Hollywood apartment. And who found Neal's body? His son, Tom Neal Jr., who was 15 years old at the time. And it gets weirder still.
Yeah.
Tom Neal Jr., as I think you know, starred in a 1992 remake of Detour, playing the part of Al Roberts. Both Tom Neal Jr. and his dad were 31 when they took the role, and they both died at the age of 58.
I did not know that. No, because I knew up to the point at which, he served 6 years of a 10-year sentence, and I knew he died not long after he was released. But I didn't know the extra details you added there.
Yeah, it's so bizarre.
And I was trying to find the Detour remake, but I didn't realize quite how off the radar it was. So I was unsuccessful in my attempts to find it streaming last night. But the word on the street is not great about the remake, is it?
No, I haven't seen it either. And in doing my research, I also ran across the fact that it's probably a blessing not to see it. Although I've heard that it's pretty faithful to the original.
Yeah, fascinating. I would like to see it just for curiosity value, you know, especially with Neal Jr. In the film. That's really fascinating. What do you make of his counterpart then, and of Anne Savage as Vera? I mean, that's a wild performance, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, it is wild. And I there's so much that's been written about Vera, and it's kind of hard to top any of it. But Eddie Muller wrote in his book Dark City, he said of Vera, let's hope there's not another one like her back home. And he says Vera is hands down the shrillest, meanest, bitchiest shrew to ever escape from Dark City. And you know, she's scarier than most characters in horror movies. I mean, she is absolutely pure venom. I've been trying to imagine what this movie would have been like if they'd allowed profanity back in 1945, even in B pictures, but I don't think it would be any worse. I mean, I think the lack of profanity makes her even more frightening than she would be with it. And I kept thinking, you know, who would you rather pick up as a hitchhiker? The, Emmett Myers from The Hitchhiker, Ida Lupino's Hitchhiker, or Vera? I think I might have to go with Myers.
I mean, it's true. She is relentless. And it's kind of interesting because you can kind of imagine them doing it another way, can't you? Where she turns into that relentless figure after we get to know her a little bit. But no, it's from the get-go. And she gets a great introduction, doesn't she? You know, where she appears quite disheveled with greasy, dirty hair. And she goes in the car and there's that great moment where it's kind of we're looking at her side on. And it's that moment I'm thinking of is when she turns to face the camera and she's got this untamed look in her eye. And I don't know, it's just a very full-on performance. It really is, isn't it? And And she takes charge at a lot of points, you know. So I'm thinking of, like, when they're with the car dealer. Like, Al has this plan and she just interjects immediately. And it just adds to this sense that he's this kind of emasculated, almost pathetic figure, I think. But yeah, what about Anne Savage then? So do you know much about her? Because what I've read suggests that she was fairly active on the noir circuit with appearances at events and so on before her death, of course. But yeah, what else do you know about her?
Well, I know that she had a maybe a little bit longer career than Neil, but she never broke out of the B picture circuit. She originally was from Columbia, South Carolina, and was a former bowling instructor, which I thought was really strange. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Muller said that she was like Susan Hayward on a Coke jag, which seems pretty frightening too. Yeah. And you know, what I didn't realize before I was doing research is that she, Anne Savage and Tom Neal, actually made three other films mm-hmm. before they made Detour. They made Klondike Kate in 1943, and then two movies in 1944, Two Man Submarine and The Unwritten Code. I think all in all, though, I mean, compared to a lot of actresses, her career was rather short, and it was mostly B. She did some television, and actually the last film she made for a long time was in 1953, an interesting Western actually called Woman They Almost Lynched. Mm-hmm. She doesn't play the woman, but she's in the film.
Yeah.
And then she played a nun in a 1986 film called Fire with Fire, mm-hmm. which I haven't seen. I can't imagine Anne Savage as a nun. And and then she was in the Guy Madden documentary / fantasy My Winnipeg, playing Guy Madden's mother.
Yeah, so that sounds fascinating, doesn't it? The Guy Madden film, because that's quite shortly before her death, I think. But good that mm-hmm. she got a notable role not long before she passed away, I think. But yeah, that's what I just picked up, really, that one of those people where you kind of look through the list of credits and there are these big gaps and things, and then you'll see something kind of odd, like she'll appear in an episode of Saved by the Bell or something, you know. And
right.
Just kind of interesting, though. Yeah, she's somebody I'd like to know more about, I think. Let's talk a bit about the style of this film then, because famously, of course, it's a very inexpensive film, as we kind of said, made quickly. Mm-hmm. And that sort of inexpensiveness, it becomes obvious in several ways, doesn't it? So I think it would jump out at most viewers. But yeah, what kind of things do you think kind of give the game away in that respect?
Well, I think one of the things that's notorious about this film is there are a lot of mistakes and problems that we see. In the beginning, we see a lot of stock footage, trains, mm-hmm. switchboard operators, things like that that are obviously stock footage. This film is in love with rear projection. It's everywhere, and it's really bad rear projection too. Also, sometimes the negative is flipped, mm-hmm. and we see people driving on the side of the road that you're used to over there. but we're not over here. Some of the lighting changes are so abrupt, and you know, there's I didn't know this is the first few times I saw it, but there's a really bad shot at the used car lot where the dealer's arm is actually blocking Al's face and partially blocking Vera. I was like, why didn't somebody catch that? But and you kind of laugh at the at the low production values, and even some of the dialogue is some of the lines are so bad they're good. You know, like there's a cute little gas chamber waiting for you, Roberts. You know.
Yeah. And the other scene I was thinking of was the studio shooting where they've got the foggy soundstage, you know, for the street scenes. We can't really see the set and so on.
Right.
And when he first meets Vera, I think her sweater apparently is kind of done up with safety pins at the back so that it's tight.
Right.
And I think when she gets in the car, you can briefly see the back of her sweater and it's apparent. Yeah. But I don't know, these limitations, they're very interesting though, aren't they? I think that's what a lot of people seem to think about this film, that it creates kind of an interesting tension with the rest of, with the kind of narrative it is, because it's almost like this road movie noir, isn't it? You have a lot of scenes on the open road, but like you say, there's so much glaringly obvious rear projection that instead of it feeling very kind of expansive, it feels very claustrophobic in a weird sort of way, doesn't it? So it seems to work kind of well, given all the stuff we said is going on with like the psychology of Al and stuff, doesn't it? So I guess it's not kind of a mark against the film in the way you might expect it to be, that the fact that you see all these kind of inexpensive things, the kind of techniques and so on.
I think if we saw this film and you were talking about Postman Always Rings Twice, that seems a little too prettied up for, well, it was an MGM film, so that was part of it. But yeah, you can't really imagine this film being prettied up and having the same effect. I mean, it's about kind of low down, dirty people in low down, dirty places. And it just looks like it. It just looks like it's low down and dirty.
Having said that, it's a cheap film. It was made quickly, etc. There's some interesting stuff kind of stylistically going on there, isn't there, that Ulmer is doing, you know, interesting stylistic things. So I'm thinking of, like, there's that shot of the oversized coffee cup that we see, for instance, where it goes from Al's face to the coffee cup to the jukebox. But, do you know what I mean? What can you think of any others that kind of things, that the flourishes he adds to it, which are kind of striking?
There are little other little things that are like that too. There's, Al's playing the piano, it looks like a really ratty looking piano, but what you hear sounds like it might be from a Steinway or something like that. Just really odd things that just kind of, and you know, it's funny that they don't really take you out of the film. At least they don't me. It's just things that you kind of store away and think, oh, this was really strange or really odd. But and the lighting, which we mentioned before, is especially when he's in the diner for the first time. It's it's like they forgot to pay the electricity bill except for the one shot on Tom Neal's eyes. It's fun to look at those things.
Yeah, and I think there's also stuff like that's when he imagines Sue performing and she's in front of the looming shadows of the musicians. That's kind of fun. And at the end of the film, when Vera is dead and the camera keeps going in and out of focus, doesn't it, as Al speaks in the voiceover. So again, that's kind of an interesting way to do and I guess it speaks to a state of, I don't know, disassociation or something. But yeah. So Ulmer, Edgar G. Ulmer, the film's director, sounds like a fascinating figure to me. So I thought we could talk about a bit about him. I mean, as other Hollywood filmmakers were, he's somebody who migrated to America from Europe. But it seems to be the case that he often kind of mythologized his own history. And it's interesting because, like, some of the books you look at about Detour, some of the sources will repeat claims that he made kind of straight. And then you'll read something else and they'll kind of flag it up as possibly unreliable. So, yeah, what do we know about his background that we can actually say is fact? Because it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is very interesting. He was a really interesting figure. And like you said, Carl, I think he invented a lot of things to his own advantage.
Yeah.
Or tried to make an advantage out of them. I'm not sure they were entirely successful. But he totally did. He fled from Nazi Germany, like many filmmakers did at that time, and was an assistant to F.W. Murnau on The Last Laugh and Sunrise, two, you know, undisputed masterpieces. And he began working in set design at Universal and was one of the first directors who worked on a film called People on Sunday with a lot of big names, including Robert Siodmak, his brother Kurt Siodmak, Fred Zinnemann, and Billy Wilder, all of whom went on to big careers, except for Ulmer. And, you know, he definitely borrowed some of those ideas of expressionism, especially the lighting, and made those ideas come alive through bargain basement methods. And if anyone has never seen The Black Cat from 1934, which Ulmer made for Universal, you know, you look at a film like that that's so odd and so striking, and you think, why was he never given more money, or why was he never given more films? Well, the story, at least the story that I read, is that he made The Black Cat in 1934 while studio head Carl Laemmle was on vacation. And The Black Cat is such an odd film. It was so weird that when Laemmle came back and he saw the finished print, he was absolutely horrified. And it didn't help that while he was making the film, Ulmer fell in love with the movie's continuity girl, Shirley Castle, who happened to be the ex-wife of Max Alexander, Carl Laemmle's cousin. So Laemmle blackballed Ulmer from all the major studios, and and it really wasn't that bad a thing for him, because he really thrived at the low end of production. And Ulmer made a lot of what they would call ethnic short films, public service short films, in the late 30s and early 40s, and he made these very quickly for very little money. So he really knew how to work fast and cheap.
Yeah, and then like apparently towards the end of his life, he was making like very low budget films in Europe then. So it seems to be, this is what seems to be what people say, isn't it? That when it comes to Ulmer, perhaps the lack of resources available to him actually suited him in a roundabout sort of way. But I don't know if he would agree with that characterization, you know. I'm sure he would have preferred kind of the higher status as a director. But yeah, what do you think? You think this kind of situation he ended in actually played to his strengths?
Yeah, I wonder if he just kind of not gave into it, but found a comfort level in it. I'm sure he wanted to do bigger pictures with bigger budgets, with bigger stars. But, you know, some of the films that he made later were really pretty good. I mean, he did Bluebeard, Strange Illusion, The Man from Planet X, Murder Is My Beat. They weren't great films, but they were good, solid films with low budgets. It would be interesting to know what, you know, if he were around today, for him to tell us, you know, what he really was, he satisfied with what he got, or did he wish things would have been different?
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to ask him as well about how personal a film is Detour, because some people read the figure of Al as kind of a stand-in for Ulmer, don't they? In the sense that Al's someone who appears to have the talent, you know, he could be playing piano somewhere better, perhaps, but he appears to have given up hope of doing so. So people have kind of read that as kind of echoing Ulmer's career at this point. And, you know, he travels around the country, and Ulmer kind of had this wandering history too. But I guess we'll never know. I don't know if anybody ever asked him directly about that, but kind of interesting to speculate about, I suppose.
Yeah, it certainly would fit into the time pattern, because after, again, that would follow The Black Cat and the years after that where he did all of those shorts. So it could have been a very, very personal story for him. That's true.
Yeah, and it seems to me like this, we've talked about this kind of myth-making thing where he would give, you know, the stories about his past that were hard to verify. And some of that kind of extends to the story about the making of Detour itself, it seems like. Because depending on what you read, this film was either made in 6 days. You seem to see that number a lot, 6 days. Or 14, or some other number. And it's kind of interesting that there's this kind of uncertainty about that. I mean, what does your intel tell you? Which number should we think of as possibly being the most accurate?
You know, I don't see the 6 day figure disputed as much as I see the $10,000 figure disputed. I see that disputed much more, and some people have even said it may have gone up to 50 or even 50,000 or even more, maybe even up to $100,000. I kind of doubt that it went up to $100,000 for a PRC movie, but you know, you print the legend, as they say, and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things, Carl, that I think, and this goes back a little bit to what we said about how Ulmer presented things, and I think, and I didn't know this until recently, the PRC, how they got a hold of this movie was Martin Mooney, who was a former journalist who turned publicity agent, producer, ghostwriter, got the rights to Detour from a writer named Martin Goldsmith.
Yep.
And Goldsmith also worked on the screenplay. Interestingly enough, though, Mooney also produced another Goldsmith screenplay called Dangerous Intruder, which came out a few months before Detour. Now, that movie chronicles an out-of-work actress named Jenny, and she hitchhikes from Boston to New York, a shorter distance, is nearly killed by a motorist, and wakes up in a strange house. So Jenny, kind of like Al Roberts, is also a performer, fallen on hard times.
Yeah.
Now, Dangerous Intruder was Goldsmith's first movie, which got him warmed up for Detour. And Goldsmith was adapting his own novel for Detour, which was really unheard of at the time. He wouldn't have been able to do that at a larger studio. Writers just couldn't adapt their own work for the screen at that time. But, you know, Ulmer pretty much took a lot of the writing credit for Detour, which, you know, was not his. And Goldsmith always claimed he got the idea for the novel from his experience. He ran a coast-to-coast car service, and he would, you know, haul about 5 or 6 passengers in a Buick station wagon across the country, charge them $25 each. And that was how he made his money. And he picked up, he says, he picked up the story from Detour based on some of those trips. The interesting thing is Goldsmith really, really needed the cash. So he sold the rights to the novel to Leon Fromkus at PRC. And then afterward, he learned that John Garfield wanted the script for Warner Brothers, and he wanted either Ida Lupino or Ann Sheridan to play Vera. So if Goldsmith had only waited, if he had only waited for that offer, you know, we could be talking about a very different movie.
Yeah, but
ultimately, Ulmer dismissed a lot of Goldsmith's efforts and practically took a lot of the credit for himself, which is really too bad.
Yeah, because it sounds like this was a film that changed quite significantly as it was being made, doesn't it? In terms of, I think, you know, they streamlined the roles of some of the characters, and it sounds like it served to lock the film more fully into being from Al's perspective. It might have been a bit broader as originally envisioned. I think it sounds like Sue's part might have been a bit bigger. Is that kind of what you've heard?
It very well could have, because we really don't get a whole lot about Sue.
Yeah.
So that could be it. And, you know, I've heard also some ideas that really one of the subtexts for this is Al really, really wants to punish her.
Yeah.
For, you know, leaving and having the wherewithal to leave before he does and possibly gets to be more successful. And it would have been interesting if we'd had more of his story to see if that were developed a bit more.
Yeah, because her appearances later on are quite fleeting. Like at one point, there's a phone call he puts into her, and we hear him talking. We don't hear what she says. We see one shot of her kind of listening, and that's it. But yeah, that's really interesting. One of the things that struck me was Robert Polito's essay in the Criterion release, in the booklet. He gets into this idea about the talk that perhaps Ulmer didn't really direct the film himself. Because perhaps somebody called Lou Landers did. He appears to have been listed as the director on some documents. It seems like he was paid for his work on the film. And it reads as if it can't be entirely explained what happened there. So maybe Landers' salary for another film was absorbed into the Detour budget or something like that. But when people like Anne Savage were asked about the recollections of the film, it sounds like they always dealt with Edgar Ulmer. So there must be something going on there, but I think the notion that Ulmer didn't direct the film sounds unlikely.
I think you're right. And I think I've read some of the same things that Anne Savage said, you know, this was Ulmer's film all the way.
I suppose, this film, it has a lot of the trademark film noir qualities we expect to see, doesn't it? I mean, the flashback storytelling, the voiceover narration, the femme fatale, the doomed man, you know, just this sense of fatalism. But I guess it's worth pointing out, you know, that when we talk about the term B-movie these days, you know, we tend to use it in quite a general way, don't we? You know, we tend to use it these days to describe any kind of somewhat low-budget genre film. But a film like Detour, this is a B-movie noir in the proper sense of the word, isn't it? In the truest sense of the word.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize, really, B-movies were just the bottom half of a double feature. And, you know, they were never intended to be anything other than that. And I think a lot of people have a misconception, well, the B-movie is something that they just didn't have a lot of money for, so they just decided to make a B-movie. I think all B-movies pretty much were intended to be B-movies. Yeah. But there are B-movies, and then there's Detour.
There's a book on film noir by a guy called Eddie Robson. I'm not sure if it's one of the ones you've seen or not, but he sort of says, well, film noir is really well-suited to B-movies. And he says, for the following reasons, he says, because, you know, these are usually character-driven films. They don't have these big, elaborate set pieces, you know. Mm-hmm. Because they often had to shoot at night, because the A picture kind of has the studio in the day, the B movies shoot at night, that kind of thing. And he says that B movies, because they were often written so quickly, I mean, that could be a problem if the film ends up not making complete sense. But in film noir, that can be kind of an advantage, you know, because we're used to these kind of hard-to-understand narratives, and the other thing is you can kind of paper over the cracks by putting in the voiceover and stuff, you know. So I don't know, I guess it's like these restrictions are not necessarily a thing we have to celebrate. I imagine in a lot of cases it must have been very frustrating for filmmakers. They didn't have the time or the money or the actors that they must have craved, you know. But I guess it's just that in this case, specifically with Detour, isn't it, those limitations kind of tallied up quite well with this director and this story and the subject matter in a funny sort of way that you couldn't really plan, I guess.
I think so. And, you know, we think about it. I mean, it's great that we're talking about these films, you know, so many decades after they were made. But you wonder if the people making them, they probably didn't think anything about the longevity of these films. They thought, I'm making this B picture for, you know, and as soon as I finish this one, it's on to the next one. I don't think any of those people making them ever thought that they would be, that anybody would be talking about these films, you know, in 2019 or even probably 1980.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose lots of films must have just been forgotten by the sands of time, but luckily we have exceptions like this. So yeah, what's your sense about how this film's reputation has shifted over the years? Because like, whenever I can remember seeing references to it, it always seems to have had a certain level of esteem. But I'm not really sure when that began, because it sounds like it was largely overlooked on release, doesn't it? So, I don't know, how long do you think did it take for the tide to turn?
Well, when it was first released, I really don't think anybody saw it. The only people that the Hollywood establishment certainly didn't see it, and probably the only people that knew about it were people that read the trade publications that covered it, and maybe they didn't even care about it. It would be interesting to talk to somebody who actually saw the film in 1945 and to get their reaction. You know, maybe like we talked about before, it was just another B film and they just watched it and went home and, you know, had dinner. But I think the film probably gained cult status because it went into the public domain. Mm-hmm. And it played a lot on television, and it just kind of gained a cult status. And I think the themes of claustrophobia and paranoia play really, really well. And, you know, maybe we wouldn't even be talking about this film either if it weren't for Anne Savage's performance, which is just it really does make Detour unforgettable. And nobody who's seen it has forgotten it. And one of the things, Carl, I didn't realize is that Vera and Savage's character doesn't even appear until the film's halfway over.
Yeah, it's like 33 minutes or something, isn't it? I thought that the second time I watched the film. I couldn't remember how long it took to get to her. Yeah. So she makes quite a massive impression in a very short space of time, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very short space of time.
Yeah. 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 And so in terms of this film's reputation, I suppose by 1992, we get the remake. And that's also the same year, apparently, but this film was selected for preservation by the Library of Congress. So that's interesting. And now we've got this Criterion release, which is really good, I think. Well worth picking up. Like you say, it's got that fascinating documentary about the efforts put into the restoration. And it's worth re-emphasizing that the efforts they've put in have borne fruit, haven't they? Because the film really does look great. Whereas apparently, like you said, some of the DVD releases have been transferred from pretty poor quality prints. So yeah, no, this is kind of like the definitive way to see Detour now, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and it's got some interesting stuff on there, like there's a new interview with a film scholar, Noah Eisenberg, which is kind of interesting, and a documentary from, I think it was from the early 2000s, where they talked to people like Anne Savage, but also people like Joe Dante and John Landis about, the film and Ulmer more generally, and it's about an hour and 15 minutes, that doc, I think. It's good stuff. What should people read, then, if they want to find out more about Detour? I only just discovered that apparently there's a BFI monograph on the film, but I didn't know that until yesterday, or I would have picked that up.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
And I try to keep up with those BFI books. that would be great. Well, you can find a lot of articles written about Detour, and I found a few in some of the reference books I have. The one where I got a good bit of information is Eddie Muller's book, Dark City, where he devotes at least a couple of pages to it and a lot of the background about the writer Goldsmith and some of the things about Ulmer. But you can just Google Detour 1945, Google Tom Neal, and you'll hear some of the things that we talked about and maybe even more. But and the Criterion disc itself is like you said, the essay is wonderful. The documentary on Ulmer, which is actually longer than the film itself, is well worth seeking out. And you know, I think it just goes to show you that, you know, you should consider these B films. I know a lot of people sometimes at the library we talk about B films. I really haven't shown many of them. But they kind of dismiss them and say, you know, I really don't want to see that. But, you know, there's a lot in them. And we talked about the time element, too. But, you know, they were actually able to get away with a lot more with some of these movies than you could with the A pictures. And, you know, Detour, I think, is really the crowning achievement of low budget film noir. And, you know, if you haven't seen it, you're really doing yourself a disservice. Mm.
So you mean able to get away with more because they were less scrutinized, because they were seen as a bit more disposable? Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. And some of the stylistic things, of course, we talk about overlooking. And I you probably could have had somebody as vile as Vera in an A picture, but I don't think it would be as down and dirty. And I don't think, you know, her character would have been quite the same in an A picture. I may be wrong.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to ponder, though. Yeah. And just on books more generally about noir, like I said, the one I mentioned by Eddie Robson is decent, and that has quite concise rundowns about relevant key films. So you normally get about 10 pages, and it sort of breaks down the story and who the director is, what their background was, and the cast, and so on. So if people are interested in reading up about noir more generally, that's not a bad place to start, I would say. I don't know, what do you think, like, noir books 101 is? What would be, like, the first port of call? Would it be the Eddie Muller book you mentioned there? Or?
I think the Eddie Muller book is very, very good. And, you know, one of the first books I ever read on film noir was The Dark Side of the Screen, Film Noir, by Foster Hirsch.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which is a very, very good introduction. Both of those are really good. And, you know, I was just poking around here and I almost forgot about this book, and I should have consulted it. But there's a really nifty little book called Death on the Cheap, The Lost B-Movies of Film Noir by Arthur Lyons. Mm-hmm. It's been a few years since I read it, and I'm pretty sure Detour is in here and a lot of other B-movies that are pretty easy to find. Some of them are quite difficult to find, but it's definitely worth reading.
Good stuff. And yeah, that Foster Hirsch book, I've had a look at that. And I think he wrote a book called, it was about neo-noir, and it was called Detours and Lost Highways, which I thought was a very evocative title. But I haven't seen the neo-noir book, but yeah. All right, Andy. So yeah, this has been fun. So we're clocking in. We haven't gone as long as the film itself. Not quite, but... But yeah, Andy, tell us about where to find you online and stuff, and what you've been up to these days on the website and things like that.
Sure. Well, we are getting ready for Noirvember, which I know this episode will be in celebration of Noirvember. I'm going to, in addition to my film festival that I'm going to do at the library, I've got some articles coming out. One that I'm writing for the Dark Pages called, or actually I don't have a title for it yet, but it's about... The Big Heat. In fact, they're going to have a giant issue devoted only to The Big Heat. And I can't really talk about what aspect of it that I'm writing about, but I'm very much enjoying it. I used to do 30 film noir titles in 30 days for Noirvember. I'm going to have to cut that back because of the film festival. I just won't have time to do that. But you can find my writing at andywolverton.com.
Yep.
I keep a blog there and talk a little bit about the movies that we are going to show at the library. My Twitter account, if you want to follow me on Twitter, is awolverton77. And I'm also on Letterboxd as awolverton. And so I would love to connect with people there. That would be wonderful.
Great stuff. Thanks, Andy. Always a pleasure. And this is our last November installment for this year, but we will be back before the end of the month. We'll be back... just before the end of November, talking about The Wizard of Oz. And that should be fun because that's a crossover episode between this podcast and the guys from the 250, Darren Mooney and Andrew Quinn. So I'm very much looking forward to bringing that episode to you. But that's all for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.